Coming up, Judy Valente on dedicated people in Chicago trying to do something about the gun violence that's already led to more than 700 shootings so far this year. And Episcopal priest and former U.S. Senator John Danforth on the compromise and sacrifice it might take to repair the country's political system.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Leaders of the Christian minority in Pakistan are demanding more government protection in the wake of last Sunday's suicide bombing that targeted their community. A Taliban splinter group claimed responsibility for the attack at a public park where Christians had gathered to celebrate Easter. More than 70 people were killed, almost half of them children. Hundreds of others were injured. Most of the victims were Muslims. American Christian, Jewish, and Muslim groups were among those condemning the attack. At the Vatican, Pope Francis called it vile and cowardly. He prayed that God would, quote, stop the hands of the violent. At the annual White House Easter prayer breakfast on Wednesday, President Obama urged people to stand united against terrorism. He said attacks such as those in Brussels and Pakistan too often foment fear and division.
That's the intent of the terrorists, is to weaken our faith, to weaken our best impulses, our better angels.
Obama called this last Easter prayer breakfast of his presidency bittersweet. He began the tradition in 2010. The Syrian government's recapture of Palmyra has enabled experts to survey the damage done by ISIS to some of Syria's best-known artifacts and monuments. The terrorist group demolished two large temples dating back more than 1,800 years and a Roman triumphal archway. It also heavily damaged artifacts inside the city's museum. A sculpture of the Greek goddess Athena was decapitated. ISIS claims the ancient relics promote idolatry. In what came as a surprise to many after hearing oral arguments about the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate last week, the Supreme Court has invited compromise. The court asked lawyers on both sides of the debate to submit additional briefs showing how contraception coverage could be obtained by employees without the involvement of religious employers. The Affordable Care Act does not require that religious groups provide contraception coverage if doing so violates their convictions, but it does require them to allow that the coverage be made available through a third party. Little Sisters of the Poor and other religious nonprofits have challenged the mandate, arguing the requirement violates their beliefs. North Carolina has generated controversy with a new statewide anti-discrimination policy that excludes protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The bill overrules a local ordinance that provided such protections, including allowing transgender people to use bathrooms according to the gender they identify with. Meanwhile, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal has vetoed a, quote, religious liberty bill that many argued discriminated against the gay community. The bill would have allowed pastors and faith-based groups to deny services to gays. Groups supporting the bill have vowed to continue to fight for the measure. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe vetoed a similar bill this week. We have a story now from Judy Valente on the terrible gun violence in inner-city Chicago. Just this year, so far, there have been more than 700 shootings there, and some of them have taken the lives of children. Stopping this often random killing seems extraordinarily difficult, but it turns out there are dedicated people trying to do that work. Here's the first of Judy's two-part series.
Being shot at by a whole bunch of people, and I thought I wasn't gonna make it out, but I got through it.
13-year-old Justin Wallace and his friend, 17-year-old Armir Lightfoot, come on Saturdays to this local YMCA center. They come to talk.
I was walking home, and I guess they thought I was somebody or something that they was in trouble with, and they just hopped out the car and just started shooting. And I was just running fast as I can to the house.
Justin and Armir meet with men who know what it's like to be shot at, former combat veterans.
When I was being shot at in Afghanistan, I was scared too, but you know, sometimes feeling scared, that's what gets you to manage to stay alive.
The soldiers and the teens are part of a 16-week YMCA program called Urban Warriors. But for these youngsters, the firefights don't take place in an overseas war zone. They explode in their own neighborhoods. Eddie Bocanegra is head of the YMCA Office of Youth Safety and Violence Prevention. He grew up in a neighborhood much like the one where Justin and Armir live.
You leave your home and you're walking to a school and you're walking through these war zone communities between gangs that are fighting each other from block to block in many cases. You look at these houses that have been abandoned, you see debris of garbage everywhere, you see prostitution happening in one corner, on the other corner you see the drug sales, and that's your landscape.
Bocanegra was once in a gang himself. He served time in prison for killing another teen in a revenge shooting. Now a graduate of the University of Chicago, Bocanegra spends his days trying to keep boys like Justin and Armir out of gangs. But it's a daily struggle.
The truth is, gangs replace social services in many cases where communities or society fall short in. When people join gangs, a lot of times it's because it's a safety issue, protecting their siblings, for example. And especially when the caregivers are either not present, either because they're at work or because they've been deported or incarcerated. I mean, that there's a void there that the gangs tend to fill in.
2016 is shaping up to be another bloody year in Chicago's most troubled neighborhoods. Chicago was already reeling from several high-profile violent incidents late last year. In one that made national headlines, 9-year-old Tyshawn Lee was shot several times execution style in an alleyway where he had gone to play basketball. 3 gang members have been charged with his murder. One of them told police he wanted to kill, quote, grandmas, mothers, kids, and all, in retaliation for his own brother's shooting death. And last November, after a white officer was shown on video shooting a black teenager 16 times, angry protests broke out in the heart of Chicago's main shopping district. The incident led to the officer's indictment on a murder charge, the firing of Chicago's police superintendent, and calls for Mayor Rahm Emanuel to resign. Through it all, groups like Urban Warriors and other grassroots efforts have tried to steer kids away from gang recruitment. Increasingly, there are calls for churches to become more involved with at-risk teens and more active in helping to stem the violence.
I've seen a lot of pastors from smaller churches who would never open their doors to our kids.
Greater Bethesda Missionary Baptist Church in Chicago's Washington Park neighborhood is a church that does open its doors. Reverend David Watkins III says he needs to be more than a pastor to his congregation. He has to be a community preacher.
This community should be better off because as a church, we are in it.
Watkins Church has teamed up with a local elementary school to provide a host of activities on Saturdays through a program called Paving the Way.
Good morning, everybody.
Activities range from cooking lessons to creative writing.
Because I want you guys to be heard, okay?
To rewriting the lyrics in rap songs that reference violence to give them a more positive message.
Everywhere I go, I see the kids on the corner, smoking that stuff, trying to sell marijuana.
Here on the corner, fights for his life, but I know what's wrong, but I know what's right.
drumming classes for the older boys, and where props are sometimes almost as big as these tiny dancers. For some, choreographing their own dance routines becomes a lesson in teamwork and leadership.
So what can be improved? Yeah?
More practice.
Yeah, more practice.
Watkins says he is trying to redefine what it means to be church.
Church for us is really service and commitment in the community, making a difference, changing lives, sharing God's love in tangible ways, not just on Sunday, but more importantly, Monday through Saturday.
Often these programs do lead kids back to church. That's what happened to Antonio Davis, who coordinates Paving the Way and personally mentors about 50 boys. Davis joined a street gang when he was 6 years old.
It felt like family, that father figure that I was looking for. You know, they played that role.
By the age of 19, Watkins wanted out. He was facing jail time for aggravated battery. His grandfather insisted he go down to Watkins Church. And there was another pressing reason. He had an infant son.
I had my guys around me and, you know, they was dropping like flies. Everybody was getting killed and everything. And so when I had him, you know, it was like, I'm responsible for a life now, you know, and I didn't want him in that life that I lived.
Davis says in recent years, gang life has become less structured and more violent.
Now it's the little boys that's, you know, out here, and you can't even call them gangs because it's one corner against the next corner. You know what I'm saying? There's little factions. And, you know, they killing each other over Facebook. You know, Snapchat, it's ridiculous out here.
When Antonio came to us as an angry black man, making $5,000 a week doing drugs, we said, look, man, you can help us around here. We can only pay you $100. Whatever he needed, we were willing to do whatever it took to get it.
A seemingly insurmountable problem is the constant flow of guns into the city. Cook County Juvenile Judge Colleen Sheehan says many of the youths in her courtroom are there on gun charges. She recalls asking one young man with no prior record what he was doing with a gun.
He looked at me with sort of surprise, like, what do you mean did I get this gun? I just got it from a friend. It was that easy. It was as if I asked, you know, where'd you get the candy bar?
Father Dave Kelly is the chaplain at the Cook County Juvenile Detention Center.
I have a 14-year-old carrying a gun because he knows life is short, he knows he's at risk, and he knows adults won't protect him, so he has a gun.
The message has been taken up by Chicago Archbishop Blaise Supich. The archbishop wrote an open letter to children in the community after 9-year-old Tyshawn Lee was killed.
I said to the young people, you should be upset. The adult world has failed you.
In addition to seeking a ban on assault weapons, Supich is calling for stricter background checks and holding both gun sellers and manufacturers accountable. He is urging Catholics to consider gun control a pro-life issue.
We have to take this in hand and put aside various divisive and political arguments that serve no one's purpose at all. We have a crisis on our hands. It is a death epidemic that we can stop if we take action, but we need to come together, and the first step is enacting proper gun safety rules.
Leaders from the Archbishop to Watkins of Greater Bethesda Baptist Church to the YMCA's Boca Negra recognize that their efforts, while important, are but stopgap measures. They say what's needed is a comprehensive approach to many complex social and economic problems.
We just don't have a real clear understanding of how to address the root causes of violence. We come at it from a very punitive approach to address those issues, as opposed to thinking about a way where we could identify those individuals and find ways to support them and their families.
Fatherlessness, education, we want to talk about jobs. What we know about black men right now is 50% of them here in Chicago don't have access because they don't have the appropriate training.
Do you ever feel here in Washington Park that what you're doing is a drop in a big ocean?
Sometimes the issues, the concerns, and even the pain that's resident in the community, it can be overwhelming. However, part of the hope of the gospel is that even in the midst of despair, you always have a way out. There's always a new way. There's always hope at the end of the day.
And Watkins says it will also take a long-term effort and plenty of partnerships to stem the flow of violence. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in Chicago.
Next week, we have part two of Judy's report, how some creative men and women in Chicago are trying to care for those, especially the young, who might otherwise be a gang's next member or victim. Now, religion and politics. Historians say the two fields have often been intertwined, but some also say if religion gets mixed with partisan politics, the system can break. John Danforth is a retired U.S. senator, a former ambassador to the UN, and an Episcopal priest. He told Lucky Severson what's needed, among other things, is compromise and the willingness, if necessary, to lose.
Well, we're at the brink. We're just hours away from a possible government shutdown.
I talked to the president earlier tonight. I'm not going to negotiate. I'm not going to negotiate. We're not going to do this.
I have a very simple message to John Boehner. Let the House vote. Stop trying to force a government shutdown.
Congress is so much different now than it was then, because then it was functioning as it was intended to function.
Former Missouri Senator John Danforth talking about the Congress he retired from in 1995, when, in his view, it was still working. The respected three-term Republican Episcopal priest and UN ambassador wrote a book about what he thinks went wrong. He remembers several years ago when he was attending a high-level political meeting.
The advisor said that whereas in the old days the idea to win an election was to appeal to independents, people in the center, and this advisor said, well, we're not going to do that in this election. We're going to try to energize the base. And we're going to stress issues which are very, very important to the Christian conservatives. So religion became divisive. It became a good part of wedge issue politics.
He says the problem with the infusion of religion into politics is that it twists compromise into a bad word.
And there's a threat that is issued regularly to incumbents that if you do compromise and work with the other side, you're going to be primaried. That's the new verb, to be primaried.
Let me first of all say, to God be the glory.
Ted Cruz won the Iowa caucus with the help of hundreds of churches, thousands of evangelicals, and one man in particular, Bob Vanderplatz, known as a kingmaker. Vanderplatz is CEO of the nonprofit Influential Family Leader. He immediately took off on the campaign trail with Ted Cruz and left us with his assistant, Nathan Ottman.
Our system certainly has its failings, but I would probably differ from Danforth in using the word broken, because we still send representatives to Congress. They still vote.
The Family Leader is an umbrella organization that offers guidance to evangelical churches in Iowa, and they're very good at it. Most Republican candidates look for an endorsement from the Family Leader, which this year didn't endorse anyone, although its leader, Vanderplatz, did endorse Cruz.
This past election cycle, we contacted, I think, around 2,000 churches across the state and just encouraged them to participate in the caucuses. Just to view it as a responsibility that they have before God to make an impact in their culture. And according to the numbers, there were nearly 50,000 more evangelicals that came out.
The problem Danforth sees in mixing religion with politics is that too often issues that are purely political in nature become religious doctrine. Gary Gutting, a professor of philosophy at Notre Dame, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times expressing the same concern about the Family Leader in particular.
It would be one thing to say, well, we want you to have good Christian-style values, or even maybe we want you to believe in Jesus Christ. But they claimed that based on biblical principles, you could get conclusions like we should, the only really acceptable economic system is laissez-faire capitalism. And that there's derivable from the Bible, I recall they said, a right of citizens to bear arms, a la the Second Amendment. And I thought that was so extraordinary and such a logical leap that it ought to be called attention to.
Some might think that issues like small government are not religious in nature, but they are to the family leader.
Government should be limited, but it should be limited to do those things which God has ordained for it to do.
The chairman of the Notre Dame Political Science Department, David Campbell, co-authored a book based on two comprehensive studies about the role of religion in American society.
What we find is one of, if not the primary cause for the stunning rise in the percentage of Americans, especially young Americans, who now say they have no religion. One of the primary causes is an allergic reaction to the mixture of religion and politics, and specifically religion and conservative politics. That shows up very clearly in our data and in the work of other scholars.
His book, co-authored with Harvard's Robert Putnam, is called American Grace: How Religion Divides and Unites Us.
I don't really think politics and religion has been more mingled of late than it has throughout our history. It's always been fairly mingled in American life.
Most importantly, I brought my Bible.
The insertion of religion into American politics, that's not new. That's been around for a long time. What's different about our current era is the injection of religion into partisan politics. It takes a very partisan tone.
Mending politics is a central theme of Danforth's new book. It's titled The Relevance of Religion: How Faithful People Can Change Politics.
My book is about the tone of politics rather than specific issues.
For starters, Danforth says that people need to realize that God is not political, ideological, or partisan, and that the essence of religion is that the self is not at the center of the universe.
Kennedy's inaugural speech being, you know, a famous one, ask what you can do for your country. This is really what religion is all about. It is saying that you and your individual needs and wants are not the center of the universe.
John Danforth wants to insist that compromise is part of the spirit of religion. I think that is true. Sometimes it is the religious attitude to say we're tolerant, we're open, we listen to other people, we try to come to terms with them.
You know, if you're in the peanut gallery, which is where I am right now in politics, it's very easy to say somebody else should do something, and so take this for what it's worth. But it's very important that at least some politicians be willing to lose.
Really?
And that is that
you
they're...
You mean to stand for something even if it means...
Yeah, and not just pander.
The former senator says that religion should be a unifying force and that the faithful should make it their mission to get politicians to work together and to compromise.
And it's important for people in office to make it clear by word and deed that people on the other side of an issue are not demonic, they're not bad people. And I think this is what religion offers. It is a place, when it's functioning as it should, where different people come together with all different ideas and different backgrounds, and they are all children of God.
When we last spoke with John Danforth, he was not very optimistic about the tone and noise of the political year so far. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in St. Louis.
Catholics around the world are mourning the death of Mother Angelica, the conservative nun who founded EWTN, the Eternal Word television network. She died on Easter Sunday at the age of 92. Mother Angelica began her broadcasting career with just $200, creating television spots in a makeshift studio in the monastery's garage. She was known for her conservative beliefs, sometimes scolding church leaders she felt were too lax in their teachings and practices. Today, EWTN claims to be the largest religious media network in the world, broadcasting in 145 countries and territories. Finally, on our calendar this coming week, Hindus celebrate their New Year. And for many Hindus in India, there's a rare opportunity for worship this year. In western India, dozens of temples submerged in the Godavari River have resurfaced because of a severe drought. The last time the 13th century structures were exposed was in 1982. Many Hindus are coming to pray there before the temples are flooded once again. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website, including more about the Christian minority in Pakistan. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, music from the Greater Bethesda Missionary Baptist Church in Chicago.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.